Bankers Association for Foreign Trade presents audio cassettes of the 63rd Annual Meeting, recorded live in Boca Raton, Florida, May 13th through 15th, 1985. This keynote address is by the Honorable John H. Chafee, United States Senate.
Fortunate and privileged to have as our keynote speaker for the International Trade and Finance Session, the Honorable John H. Chafee of Rhode Island. Senator Chafee serves as the chairman of the Republican Conference, which formulates basic policy on all major issues. He is one of three U.S. senators who meets regularly with the President of the United States on these very key topics that are of interest to all of us. In this capacity, and with his involvement on the Senate Finance Committee, Senator Chafee has been actively involved in a day-to-day environment on trade, tax, and certainly a topic of significant interest to all of us, the budget. Senator Chafee received a truly balanced New England education. He has an undergraduate degree from Yale and a Harvard Law degree. He served in the Marine Corps during World War II and was called again to active duty to serve in Korea. He was elected for three terms to the Rhode Island House and was Secretary of the Navy between 1969 and 1972. His political success does tell much about the man. In 1962, he was elected governor by that whopping margin of 398 votes, which I think is fairly narrow in any political context, in any political race. He was then reelected in 1964 and again in 1966, both times by the largest margins in the state's history. In 1976, he became a United States Senator, winning 58% of the vote. His victory marked the first time in 46 years that a Republican had been elected to the Senate from Rhode Island. Certainly, we international bankers can benefit and perhaps learn from his experience. He has shown clearly over his career remarkable success in operating successfully in what could possibly be described as a potentially hostile political environment. That's something we can all learn from. It is indeed a privilege to welcome a very distinguished senator and a true gentleman, the Honorable John Chafee.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chuck, for that kind introduction. I'm delighted to be here with you in this lovely setting. I must say I think you choose well for your annual gatherings. Now, you're here today because of your interest in international trade and especially the U.S. role therein. And what I'd like to do this morning briefly is to share with you some thoughts about trade as seen from the viewpoint of the U.S. Senate. I speak as a senator. I'm not a member of the House. I'm not a member of the administration. Now, clearly, while the U.S. seems prosperous, and we all look around, particularly looking out from the tower down on the inland waterway, things don't seem too tough. And employment is at record highs. Unemployment, unfortunately, is too high. There was good growth in the nation in 1984. Inflation is hovering around 4%. Nonetheless, there's a deep concern in Congress over our trade deficit. In the first quarter of 85, import of manufactured goods was up 5%, exports were down 1%, and a merchandise deficit of $28 billion. Which is just extraordinary when you look at the history of the country, that in one quarter we can run a deficit of $28 billion. And of course, the devastating effects of this is seen in the farm region. Wheat exports down, corn, soybeans, cotton, textiles. I have a lot of friends in the textile business, as many of you do too. They tell me that the import situation is the worst in their lifetimes, and many of them have been in the business for a good number of years. Mills are closing. Converters are folding up. It's just very, very tough times for many industries. In our state, we have a machine tool industry, which has just been put on the rocks by the imports, especially from Japan. Quality machines sold at very low prices. It seems apt that the Business Council meeting last weekend at Hot Springs, West Virginia, chose as a topic, as one topic, for the first time ever, they chose a single topic, and that single topic was the soaring U.S. trade deficit. So those leaders of the major companies in the United States are seeing this as a tremendous problem that they're trying to struggle with. And I think they aptly said, quite accurately said, that what we're seeing in the United States today is the deindustrialization of America. Now, we're all just going to end up being hotel managers and Burger King, or operating Burger King stands. I don't know. If there's a concession out there, get it, though. Now, at Hot Springs, one of the administration officials didn't give the U.S. federal deficit as the number one cause. You might have noticed in the paper that he listed three more important causes for the trade deficit than that. First, the debt problems of the third world nations and their inability to buy U.S. goods. Second, the failure of the European economies to pick up steam. Third, the slow pace of Japan to internationalize its yen. And fourth, the strong dollar. Well, maybe those first three causes are more important than the strong dollar. But it's clear that the only one of those four factors that were listed that we can affect as U.S. senators is the strength of the dollar. And it seems to me to make much more sense to tackle those problems we can influence rather than moan over those matters that are beyond our control. So let's do what we can. And that's the attitude we've taken in the Senate. And we are absolutely convinced, the Republicans in the Senate, and indeed I think the Senate as a whole, is absolutely convinced that the strong dollar flows from the high U.S. interest rates, which flow from the U.S. federal deficits. The deficits, as you know now, are running over $200 billion a year, which is about 5% of our GNP. Now, the Senate Republicans met in January when we first came back to Washington, and we set the following goals. We set as a goal for 1986, the budget we're now dealing with, that the deficits be 4% of GNP, and then the following year that they be 3%, and in 1988 they be 2% of the GNP. We work in three-year segments. And that the deficit in dollars be down to $100 billion in 1988. Now, that's not exactly a cause for rioting with excitement in the streets that you got your deficit down to $100 billion, but nonetheless, it's a lot better than where we are now. And this glide path, if followed, would get the deficits down to zero in 1990. Now, the president set up some constraints in our approach to the budget, constraints he set forth, namely no new taxes, no additional taxes, no increase in taxes. Secondly, no cut in his defense budget. And third, no tampering with Social Security. Well, that makes life a little difficult. And what he came forward with, and Mr. Stockman, the budget director, came forward with originally, was a program that essentially involved balancing the budget or getting the deficits down through draconian cuts in social spending. Well, we struggle with this, and we've been at it for over 3 months. And into it, when we finally got started into the budget itself about 2 weeks ago on the floor, we jettisoned the defense goal of no cuts in defense, and we got that down to in effect, a freeze in defense, namely the 85 figure plus the inflation factor, which we call zero. And then in the out years, we gave 3% real growth, and after that, 3% real growth in both 86 and 87. As far as Social Security goes, if there's ever a hot button, as far as politicians are concerned, it's Social Security. I spoke out, I ran for re-election in 1982. I'd never done anything to Social Security. I'd always been for it. I'm always for motherhood and Social Security and controversial programs like that. And I was four square for Social Security. But somehow the word got around that the Republicans were going to tamper with Social Security. And just to show you that what that did, on the week before the election, I had 58% in the polls. And when they finished a week of TV saying what Chafee might do to Social Security, I won by 51.2%. Now, that's a very sobering experience. And when we got into this budget, it soon became clear that we couldn't solve the problem without dealing with Social Security, because that's the major entitlement program. The other entitlement programs being the other retirement, some of them being the other retirement programs, military, postal, civil servants. And it hardly seemed fair to cut out their cost of living adjustment and those other retirees and not do it for Social Security. And furthermore, it was in Social Security that the big dollars were. So we, in the budget we came forward with, and we presented as the Republican leadership, Social Security cost of living was originally in the package was to be scaled back to 2%, 2%, 2% over the 3 years. What we finally came up with was no Social Security cost of living adjustment for the first year, and then they would, and then we reverted to the cost of living adjustment for the out years. Both of those programs saved the same amount. It seemed better to us, I certainly feel that way, if you're going to not give the Social Security cost of living adjustment, do it in 1 year and get it over with, rather than stringing it out with some reduction for 3 years. Well, last Friday at 3:30 in the morning, we finally passed the Republican budget. It passed, as you recall, with a tie vote, 49-49, with the Vice President breaking the tie. Now, that budget did achieve the goals of getting down from that getting the deficit to 4% in 86, 3% in 87, 2% in 88, with the budget ending up at a $100 billion figure in 1988. Now, to do this took some massive cuts in spending. Now, when you're running a budget in the $800 billion plus area, you'd think you could get $50 billion out of it fairly easily. Well, it just doesn't prove to be that way. Yet, nonetheless, we reduced the budget by $56 billion in 1986. Now, what's so significant about all this? It seems to me that there are three significant points about what took place with the budget last Friday. First, as I said, we dealt with Social Security. Previous to this, Social Security had been looked on as absolutely untouchable. You just couldn't do it, deal with it, and if you did, you'd go down the drain. Well, I'll report you further in that in 1988, but we don't think that's true. Our view is that unless we do something dramatic, the country's going to be in terrible shape, whereas if we do something and solve these deficits, the future of the country is unlimited, the economic growth out there. And therefore, to me, it was a relatively easy choice. Furthermore, I think those that say you can't touch a Social Security cost of living adjustment seem to presume that the elderly are greedy, they don't give a hoot about the future of the nation, they don't care about their children's futures, jobs and interest rates, ability to buy homes and houses, and I just don't think that's so. Secondly, we dealt with Medicare. That, again, is a very sensitive subject. Now, the traditional way to deal with Medicare, which is an entitlement program, is to cut the providers, namely cut the amount that's paid to the doctors, that's paid to the hospitals. But in addition, we did all that, but in addition, we increased the premium rates for those on Medicare, the so-called Part B premium. Gets a little technical, but in any event, we required that the people pay more for their insurance that covers their doctor's fees. And thirdly, a fact I consider of considerable significance is that we ended some programs, not as many as the president wanted, but we did kill off some programs, and that's very, very difficult. There isn't a program in the federal government that doesn't have a vocal, vehement constituency. And to end some of these programs is very, very difficult. But we did that. We ended the Economic Development Administration. We ended the UDAG, the Urban Development Action Grants, that have been used to help our downtowns in many instances and also made many developers very rich. We ended the Appalachian Regional Commission, a program that President Johnson put through in 1965 to help the depressed West Virginia, but he very cleverly included about 11 states in it, parts of 11 states. So that gives you 22 senators to start with. Well, we ended that one. We ended general revenue sharing. That's money that goes from the federal government out to every county, municipality, town, city in the nation. How ridiculous. The federal government that's broke shares its revenues that it doesn't have with various cities and towns. Well, we ended that, which seemed to make some sense. We ended the Ex-Im direct loans, and I must say others are much more knowledgeable about that than I am. To me, this was an extraordinary accomplishment that this passed. I regret that we didn't have more votes. As you remember, we had to pull poor old Pete Wilson out of the hospital on a stretcher to vote. We got the 49 votes, and it looked very nice to have the vice president up there breaking the tie. Seems to me the great winners in this and the ones that deserve the credit are, of course, Senator Bob Dole, our leader, Senator Pete Domenici, chairman of the Budget Committee, and David Stockman. David Stockman has been maligned in this country and indeed in the Senate. But his knowledge of these various programs, his persistent advocacy that they can be cut and they ought to be cut, it was a major factor in our understanding them and being able to achieve the results. And the president. The president was very helpful. The president is often described as an ideologue, but he can switch positions as fast as anybody. And when he sees a good deal and sees that the program he's espoused has to be jettisoned, he'll jettison it and come aboard. And as he told us, we couldn't cut defense, it would ruin the nation. So we cut it by 3%, and he said it was a very fine move. The country would be all right. Now, what happens next? This budget goes to the House of Representatives. And there they have to wrestle with it. No longer can they stand on the sidelines and say, we're not going to balance the budget in the backs of the poor. The elderly will not suffer under us. Well, let's see how they're going to do it. They talk blithely about cutting defense some more. Well, I'll tell you, we've got defense honed down pretty far. And you can eliminate all the $600 toilet seats and the $500 hammers, but you're not going to be able to cut it much more. And the House of Representatives is soon going to find that that's not as easy as they think. And when they start cutting defense or attempting to cut defense more, they'll find not only does it affect a lot of programs they're deeply involved with, the manufacture of tanks and Detroit, the construction of building of airplanes, the construction of ships, whatever it might be, but also you begin to fool around with the military readiness of the nation. Now, I'll make a prediction. I predict that the House will come forward with a budget nearly exactly the same as the Senate has. That we've broken the ground now in these untouchable areas of Social Security. I think that the one difference probably will be that they won't have any increases in Medicare for the elderly. And I think they'll probably put some money back in for some domestic programs, UDAG, for example, and some others. But basically, I think they'll come up with the same budget that we have. After they've huffed and puffed and gotten out all their press releases, they'll find that the budget we sent them was a darn good budget and fair for the nation and good for the future. Now, if they do this, if they come forward with a budget basically the same, I think the future of the nation is going to be on a very good course. I think that interest rates will come down. I think that exports will be encouraged or be assisted and helped. I think that the stock market's truly going to take off, and I think it's going to be a major factor in reducing our trade deficit. I don't think it's going to happen overnight. But it's going to happen. Now, I'd like to give you a couple other further views on trade matters. First, protectionism. Is protectionism coming on strong? Well, you hear a lot of talk about it. You hear a lot of talk about surcharges, about quotas. But frankly, I don't think this protectionist sentiment is half as strong as you might think it is. I sit in the Finance Committee, which deals with trade matters and deals with all tariff and surcharges or whatever they might be. And frankly, there isn't the sentiment there that has caused so much concern in our country about protectionism. And furthermore, this is one area where the president is absolutely opposed. And I made some jokes earlier about the president being able to switch positions, but that's just those positions where he switches or adjustments. This is a fundamental belief with him that free trade is good for the world, and he doesn't want to be remembered as any smooth Hawley, and therefore he has been opposed to trade restrictions. We saw that, of course, in the domestic content legislation that the House passed to provide that every automobile that came into the country from Japan had to have X percentage based on the number of 100,000 automobiles coming in, X percentage of American content, working its way up to 90% in Toyotas coming into the United States had to have American-made parts in them, American value up to 90%. The president was opposed to that, and he's opposed to this talk of protectionism. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't plenty of frustration and anger, but principally with Japan. And the belief is that Japan, more than any other nation, benefits from the free and open access that exists now in the world, and particularly to the U.S. And yet they refuse to eliminate their non-tariff trade barriers to permit U.S. goods to flow in to Japan. And this doesn't mean that we're seeking a trade balance, that whatever Japan buys from us, sells to us in dollars, we must be able to sell them in dollars. Not at all. If Japan makes a better automobile or a better camera or a better dental drill or wherever it is and wants to sell it in the U.S. and can sell it at a better price, three cheers. Our consumers benefit. But at the same time, we should be able to sell our goods in Japan that are superior in telecommunications, pharmaceuticals, and others. And that's what we're seeking. Now, we're having a tough time on this. There's no question about that. And we've tried to put pressure on the Japanese in a host of ways. I like to think that it's getting better. And we're going to have further reports on this and monitor this as we go along. And many of us have in pretty tough retaliatory legislation. I think I'm viewed as a stronger protector of free trade as anybody in the Senate. But I believe that if the Japanese are not going to let into our telecommunications equipment into Japan on a free and open basis, then we should stop their telecommunications equipment coming in here. That's pretty tough stuff. But somehow we've got to get the message to them. And obviously talk hasn't succeeded to date. Now, what about a new round of trade negotiations? As you know, there's a top priority of the president. Some cold water was thrown on it by the French. I believe it's in the U.S. interest to have this new round, both to cover services, to cover certain high-tech areas, to cover access for foreign investment. In the Senate, the leading Democrats, leading trade Democrats, Senator Benson and others, and also Senator Danforth, the Republican chairman of the Trade Subcommittee of the Finance Committee, they are opposed to a new round of trade negotiations. Their view is that we now have powers under 301, the existing laws that we have, to open up markets, and the president isn't using these tools. And that before we go into some kind of new trade negotiations, the president ought to use the tools we've got and to end the unfair trade practices that currently exist. Despite this opposition, I think the U.S. is going to press ahead with trade negotiations. And it may be that we'll just deal with those nations that are prepared to deal with us. If the French don't want to deal, so be it. This is going to take a time, but nonetheless, I think we're going to proceed. And finally, a word about funding for the World Bank and the IMF. I know anybody who sits in the sidelines, it's like following the perils of Pauline, trying to see the U.S. Congress deal with the funding for the IMF and the World Bank. And those agencies get shot at from both sides, from the ultra-conservatives and from the ultra-liberals. The ultra-liberals get angry because these agencies sometimes loan to South Africa, and that's wicked. The other side gets angry because the IMF imposes too tough conditions on the LDCs. And furthermore, the right wing doesn't like the lending to some of these wild-eyed socialist countries that are so upsetting. The feeling is, why don't we deal bilaterally instead of multilaterally? Why do we have all these international groups that we help fund? Nonetheless, I think wisdom will prevail and common sense will come through. Now, that's a dangerous prediction, but Nonetheless, I think it will happen, and that when all said and done, somehow the funding, whether it's on a continuing resolution or how it is, will permit the U.S. funds to continue to flow to those organizations and in others. Now, in conclusion, I just want to say that I'm very optimistic for the trading future of the U.S. We've got a lot to overcome. The effects of the strong dollar aren't going to go away rapidly. And I think this business about the deindustrialization is absolutely true. And trying to reverse it isn't going to happen overnight. The plants are there, the investment is there, and it's not going to come back into the country. Nonetheless, I think we have an ability to adjust. And furthermore, I think we've got a lot to learn about selling overseas. And I have some sympathy for the Japanese in that they say we just don't try hard enough. And I think that's probably true in many instances. But I believe, especially if we can get these federal government deficits reduced, that there's cause for considerable optimism and faith in the future for our country. Thanks an awful lot. It's a delight to be here. Thank you.